So the question then is, and it's really the $64 question, why then did the rate of profit fail to recover? And in particular, why don't we see what we normally should expect to see? Any economist, you can be a leftist, or fixed lines of production, you'd see the shifting out of capital and of labor, out of low-profit realms, into high-profit industries, and the shakeout or elimination of high-cost, low-profit means of production, where it persists in the line, where there's no mobility out. Why does that adjustment process not take place? Seems to me there were three main processes at work. First, contrary to the expectations of standard economics, again, left and right, the great capitalist corporations of the advanced capitalist world did everything they could to remain in the industries that they already occupied, even though these industries were burdened by overcapacity. Only very tardily, with the greatest reluctance, did they respond to their profitability problems by withdrawing plant and equipment and labor from oversubscribed lines of production. Instead, the great corporations tried to defend their positions in the world market as long as possible by falling back on what we call their proprietary capital, capital that is, you know, specifically tied to them and their line of production, their established connections with suppliers, their links with customers, and above all, their technological prowess. GM's, you know, knows how to make cars, or they thought they did anyway. So on this basis, they sought to improve their competitiveness by cutting costs by means of expanding investment as much as they were able, even in the face of reduced rates of return. In effect, because they had built up this intangible capital, which they could only use, of course, in their own industries and couldn't transfer to new lines of production, couldn't take their technology into, you know, Microsoft's terrain, they decided to fight rather than switch. But this, of course, only exacerbated the problem of overcapacity. So a certain logic in fighting rather than switching, because that's where you have already a built-up, historically sedimented, if you will, capacity to produce, particularly to innovate technologically, and so failure to leave the line. Second, simultaneously, the opposite side of the same coin. One after another, region of East Asia, from the Northeast Asian Nicks to the Southeast Asian Little Tigers like Malaysia or Thailand to the Chinese behemoth, they extended ever further the processes of uneven development that had set off the long downturn in the first place. Like the Europeans and Japanese before them, the Asians did this by successfully exploiting the potential advantages of coming late, especially by combining their cheap but relatively skilled labor with advanced technologies borrowed from the West. The East Asian economies proceeded up the technological ladder with unprecedented speed, especially by means of ever-deepening regional integration with one another, made possible by accelerating foreign direct investment as well as by trade. On that basis, they rained down ever greater torrents of increasingly sophisticated manufacturing products on already oversupplied world markets, increasing still further distress on world manufacturing profit rates. So, in sum, what we witnessed in the face of already existing overcapacity was insufficient exit of high-cost, low-profit means of production in the core, and too much entry of low-cost, high-profit means of production in the periphery. But of course, insufficient exit and too much entry should have brought even worse overcapacity. And in fact, it did, as the manufacturing profit rate across the advanced capitalist countries was lower, for example, at the end of the 70s than it had been at the start of the 70s, and no higher at the end of the 80s than it was at the end of the 70s. Yet the question then arises, well, if overcapacity persisted and times got worse, why didn't the economy experience what we would normally expect it to experience? Much more serious recessions and even depressions, and thereby eventually the shakeout of high-cost, low-profit means of production, thereby a recovery of profitability. So if firms are so obstinate not to do what the economists tell them they should do, which is, you know, get out of those oversupplied lines and get into new ones where there's a rate of profit higher, if they have so stupid as to do that, well, they're going to build up even more overcapacity and there'll be recessions and they'll be forced out of the line. So why didn't that happen? The answer, in my opinion, is that the governments of the advanced capitalist world led to an ever-increasing extent by the United States made sure that titanic volumes of credit were made available through ever more varied and baroque channels, both public and private, to firms and households to soak up the surplus of supply over demand. And the last part of this discussion, I'll try to talk about the truly baroque forms of growth of credit that we've witnessed in the last decade or so that you guys have all participated in when you're making all that money in the stock market and then again in the housing market. Basically, what we witnessed was the historically unprecedented, ever-increasing growth of borrowing, and this allowed the world economy to ensure the demand it needed to counteract the problem of overcapacity and prevent depression. So the point is that for political reasons especially, although also for economic reasons, they'd rather, you know, not have depressions for the benefit of the firms themselves, governments would not allow the deep recessions or depressions that had historically eliminated excess capacity and allowed the economies to regain their profitability. Nevertheless, the outcome was the predicament that continued to face the world economy as it entered the new millennium in the year 2000. This was the following. On the one hand, the growth of borrowing at levels that continued to break all previous records kept up demand. And in that way, by creating demand for these goods, it prevented profitability from falling even further than it would have as a result of overcapacity. And in particular, the spectacular growth of debt kept the economy turning over in the wake of the serious recessions of 74-75, 79-82, the early 90s, and in 2001. On the other hand, so profits were kept from collapsing by demand and the economy was allowed to turn over. On the other hand, precisely because demand was kept up by growing debt, the shakeout of high-cost, low-profit means of production was slowed down and limited. As a consequence, overcapacity was continued, and just as the rate of profit failed to fall much, it failed to recover. Because the profit rate failed to recover, investment growth, employment growth, and wage growth continued slow, with the result that the growth of aggregate demand slowed and the economy was ever less dynamic. So between 1973 and the present, we didn't get system-shaking crisis as, for example, in the 1930s. What we got instead was the continuation of stagnation over three decades. As the economy entered the new millennium, the long downturn still continued. Profit rates had failed to recover, and this had provided, so to speak, the underlying or the substrate for the economic processes that made for stagnation. Again, particularly the slowed growth of demand. Okay, so that's the kind of the big picture. That's the long-term overview. Now, I want to talk quickly as I can about medium run, the main medium run that I see, the key medium run trends, so we can get as quickly as possible to the present. Okay, so that's the long run. What about the medium? From a medium run perspective, against this background, and it's crucial that keep that background in mind of failure of profitability to recover. In my view, there are two key new developments, both originating in the early 1980s. The first is the shift that everybody continues to talk about, neoliberal market opening, which led to the worsening of the problem of aggregate demand for the system as a whole. The second, against the background of marketization and declining growth of demand, there was a very major, but ultimately abortive recovery of the American economy led by its manufacturing sector, especially in the period 1985 to 95. So let's look at these two developments in order. The emergence of neoliberalism first. As I think people well understand, the initial response to falling profit rates and the problems of economic growth in the world economy in the late 60s and 70s was Keynesianism. Keynesian budget deficits on the one hand, easy credit on the other, both made possible by the government, which was designed to stimulate growth by subsidizing or pumping up aggregate demand. Nevertheless, by the end of the 1970s, Keynesianism had failed. And the reason for this, from the standpoint that I'm arguing, or I think so anyway, is clear. Government deficits and relates pretty closely to things I was just saying a minute ago. The growing government deficits, i.e. the borrowing by the government, and the resulting increased spending, did keep up growth by providing added demand. So there was no collapse. However, the additional demand had the effect of allowing high-cost, low-profit firms to continue in business rather than going bankrupt, so that Keynesian measures kept the economy going, but they also sustained the overcapacity and thereby prevented the recovery of the profit rate. The upshot was that during the 1970s, profitability did not collapse, but it didn't recover either. As a result of the low profitability of firms, though, as the 70s progressed, one saw in response to Keynesian deficits, that is, that increased demand, runaway inflation, rising government deficits, rising trade deficits, and a falling dollar. So you have demand there, but since profit rates are slow, you don't get the kind of bang for the buck that you would have expected. Firms don't invest a lot in relation to that demand. They don't employ a lot. So you get runaway inflation leading to a falling dollar. And by the end of the decade, the decline of the dollar was threatening the role of the dollar as the key international currency. And the Federal Reserve, under Chairman Paul Volcker, had to step in. The so-called Volcker shock of 1979-80 was designed to set the economy on a new path by imposing unprecedentedly high interest rates and balanced budgets. The central goal was, of course, and they made no bones about it, to increase unemployment so as to break the back of inflation, undercut workers' organization, reduce wage growth, restore profits. But the aim was also, and they knew, looking at what was right there before them, was to wipe out that huge ledge of overcapacity in manufacturing that had continued to build up under the Keynesian regime of the 70s. The increase in unemployment, decrease in wages, fall in inflation, and elimination of manufacturing overcapacity was supposed to pave the way for a whole new economy. Recovery of manufacturing profits, a shift of the economy into financial services, rising financial expansion in which rising interest rates would attract foreigners to invest in the U.S. Treasury bonds, and the U.S. would become a center of international finance. So manufacturing profitability recovery, shift into services, and making the U.S. the financial center of the world. All this was implied or hoped for in the Volcker shock. And the underlying idea, the longer-term notion, was that the government's role in guiding and supporting the economy would be lessened and the free market left to govern the economy. But the problem was that the Volcker shock gave rise to the worst recession of the post-war epoch. By 1982, the unemployment rate had risen to 12%, and this had precipitated an international debt crisis of the less developed countries, and with that, fears of world depression. The Reagan administration was unwilling to accept that further deepening of recession and a possible crash. So for political reasons, there was some, economic as well, there was some reduction. They backed off a little bit of that draconian austerity policy. And there was some reduction in interest rates, and especially, as you know, here's Ronald Reagan, Mr. Balance the Budget, we're going to, you know, have good housekeeping. He, of course, made for the biggest growth of Keynesian deficits in American history through huge expansion, military expenditures, and cuts of taxation for the corporations and the rich. The huge resulting increase in aggregate demand did save the economy by keeping profit rates from falling too much and thereby allowing growth to continue. But that same increase in aggregate demand prevented the shakeout of overcapacity that was needed in order to raise profitability. The same story, with the result that the economy continued to limp along. The result was that Keynesianism continued, and a full turn to the rule of the market didn't really take place under Reagan, even though everybody tends to think that's where the turn to the right to neoliberalism occurred. It really didn't. The discontinuity, the real turn to neoliberalism, occurred only in the early 1990s. At this point, one witnessed throughout the advanced capitalist economies not only tight credit, but also a turn to balancing the budget. In other words, finally ending Keynesian regulation and ending stimulating the economy through budget deficits. And of course, It was led by the United States under that Eisenhower Republican, Bill Clinton, who took office in 1993 and who really revised in a very radical way the macroeconomic governance of the United States under the guidance of his economics commissar, Robert Rubin, not by chance formerly the chief executive officer of Goldman Sachs, who you may have heard of. They probably were being as envious as I am of their little bonuses this year, something averaging, I think, about $15 million per person, which, of course, was nothing like the hedge fund guys are making. And today in the Financial Times, there's a big complaint about this unfairness. Although other people, of course, realize that people get paid according to their marginal productivity, and so obviously the hedge fund guys are a lot more productive than those poor fools at Goldman Sachs. Anyway, also what took place was the preparation for the Maastricht Treaty, which also brought in, to bring in a unified European currency, they also balanced the budget there. So the outcome of the combination of tight credit and balancing the budget was really dramatic. For the first time during the post-war epoch, the advanced capitalist economies were left to regulate themselves mainly by way of the free market. But the results were just the opposite of what the advocates of the free market or neoliberalism had hoped for. Since profit rates, as I mentioned, across the system still remained low, especially in manufacturing, when the demand fell as a response to tight credit and budget balancing, the response of firms was to cut costs more viciously than before, especially by laying off workers and reducing capacity. So they didn't expand in relationship to the freedom of the market, but because of the condition of low profitability, they cut costs, and that cutting costs, the flip side of that, is cutting the growth of demand. So the result was between 1991 and 1995, Europe and Japan experienced their worst recessions of the post-war period, driven by the collapse of their export sectors, and particularly the huge contraction of manufacturing. In the U.S., you may remember, this was the period of the jobless recovery, and even in the United States, a very slow comeback. Meanwhile, to make matters worse, the East Asian Knicks and the Little Tigers were experiencing their biggest export boom ever. So what the free market brought in the first half of the 1990s was not recovery, but continuing and even deeper stagnation for the world economy. The world economy economic pie was growing ever more slowly. Indeed, 1990 to 95 was the slowest period of growth up to that time, except again those years around the 74-75 recession. Okay, so that's kind of moving in closer to the present, but the second kind of element in this medium-run development has to do with that sort of the global thing. We need to kind of refine that a little and look at the geography. And the geography is that against economic geography, against the background of deepening global stagnation, the second medium-term development I want to talk about, the U.S. economy staged a very major recovery, although it had a paradoxical character. This did begin with the Volcker shock of 79-82. And at that juncture, high interest rates and a high dollar did lead, as they had hoped, to a crisis of the manufacturing sector. The resulting shakeout of high-cost, low-profit manufacturing means of production and the accompanying huge reduction of manufacturing employment initiated a rise of manufacturing productivity. So what they were doing is they took out means of production, they took out labor in this period of deep recession, but they managed to keep up output by keeping the people who were employed working harder, and that was the beginning of the recovery, a beginning of a rise in manufacturing productivity. What stained the recovery was, in the first place, a huge repression of wage growth. Employers prevented manufacturing wages from rising for 10 full years, flat wages for 10 full years in real terms. Even more important, with the so-called Plaza Accord of 1985, the leading capitalist economies agreed to bring down the value of the dollar to help the United States, and over the next decade, the dollar fell very sharply. The combination of wage stagnation and dollar devaluation brought a very major increase in U.S. international competitiveness and in manufacturing, and that brought, in turn, a huge increase in the manufacturing rate of profit, which grew by 70% between 1985 and 1995. I mean, if you want to follow this, if you look at the chart that says U.S. net profit rate indexes, look from here to here, you can see very huge recovery in manufacturing profit rate. By 1995, the rate of profit in the U.S. private sector hadn't completely recovered, but it was back to its level of 1969, the first time this had happened in a quarter century. Now, the recovery of profitability in the U.S. began to detonate what looked like, finally, the beginning of a break from that long downturn, the beginning of an economic acceleration. From 1973-74, the U.S. economy was finally witnessing big increases in the growth of investment, employment, productivity, and GDP. And it looked like the U.S. might be bringing out along a new long boom, maybe carrying the rest of the world with it. But in the end, due to the profound weakness of the world economy as a whole, the U.S. economy was unable to sustain its recovery. In other words, the U.S. was part, an inextricable part, of an interrelated global export and foreign direct investment economy. So as I emphasized, as a consequence of the continued failure of the rate of recover on a world scale, the world economic pie grew ever more slowly, and in the first half of the 90s was the worst of all. So the result, we encounter a kind of hydraulic or zero-sum dynamic where the gains secured by one country or group of them, because the pie is not growing, necessarily come at the expense of another, kind of push me, pull you. In particular, economy or group of countries which finds itself with a low currency achieves lower prices, superior competitiveness, and in that basis increases its market share. But of course, this comes directly at the expense of its rivals with a high currency and vice versa. So what happened between, if you look at the next chart, which is called Manufacturing Net Profit Rate Indexes, U.S., Germany, Japan, 1978 to 2001, you can see that when the U.S. was increasing its competitiveness, its market share, its profit rate, the opposite side of the same coin was that Germany and Japan were experiencing rising currencies, the opposite of U.S. falling ones, and falling market share, declining profitability. The gain of one came at the expense of the other. In other words, as the U.S. improved its position, Japan and Germany were feeling pressure on their profit rates, which fell as U.S. profitability gained. As the U.S. manufacturing sector was finally recovering, the manufacturing sectors of Japan and Western Europe were experiencing their worst crises of the post-war epoch. By 1995, you're beginning to have the same thing you had in 1985. Instead of the U.S. economy in trouble, the Japanese economy is freezing up. So the leading capitalist governments got together to bail out Japan as well as Germany, just as they had bailed out the U.S. a decade earlier with the Plaza Accord. The so-called reverse Plaza Accord pushed the dollar back up, brought the Japanese yen and German mark back down, and this did put a stop to their respective recessions and got them growing again. But because of this hydraulic character of the economy, the fact that the pie as a whole is not growing, as the value of the dollar rises while the yen and mark fall, the U.S. sees one of the key foundations of its recovery between 85 and 95 knocked from out beneath it. And U.S. manufacturing competitiveness declines, and U.S. profit rate falls. So if you look at the extension of that figure where the U.S. profitability had been rising, after 1995-7, it starts to fall back. So by raising the dollar value, the U.S. ended undercutting American competitiveness, and in fact, between 1995 and 2000, the U.S. manufacturing profit rate reverses course, begins a precipitous decline, and starts to send the economy into slowdown. Again, bottom line, stagnant world economy, no one can gain without somebody else losing, manifestation of continuing stagnation, itself an expression of the failure of profitability to recover. Okay. So now to move toward the end of the paper and the short-run bubblenomics that we've been living through over the last decade. The bottom line is that by 1995, the world economy was at an impasse. The turn to reliance on the free market, by which I mean to depend on government Keynesian budget deficits to push up aggregate demand, had left the advanced capitalist economies in their worst recession of the post-war era between 1991 and 1995. The U.S. recovery up to 1995, based on the low dollar, had exacerbated the problems of Western Europe and Japan. So the turn to the reverse Plaza Accord, which brought about a low yen and low mark, did reverse the recessions in Japan and Germany, but also cut off the U.S. recovery. In so doing, it brought to the fore the central underlying problem that had plagued the world economy since 73, and this was the stagnation of aggregate demand. During the length of the long downturn, the failure of profitability to recovery had meant, as I continue to emphasize, declining investment, consumption, and government demand. What had kept the world economy growing? Again, subsidies demand provided by Keynesian government deficits, especially in the U.S. In fact, Keynesian deficits had gotten ever larger between the middle 60s and the end of the 80s. But as we saw, the Clinton administration decided to balance the budget, and this put an end to the support for demand provided by government deficits. Especially since the U.S. profit rate had from 1995 begun to fall, the big question was, where is the demand going to come from that drives the world economy? It had been U.S. Keynesianism, pretty much, that was driving the economy in the absence of a profitability recovery. Now that has been disconnected, what's going to drive the economy? And this is where Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, who some of you may remember, comes in. And he has a novel plan to stimulate the U.S. economy. Never actually announced this, still has never said it, but nonetheless he did. By 1995, 1996, stock prices had already begun to rise. Money was pouring in from Japan in the wake of the reverse Plaza Accord into U.S. Treasury bonds to push the dollar up. But this also pushed down long-term interest rates, and this stimulated the stock market. The dollar rising also stimulated the stock market, pushing up the value of stocks. So equity prices at this point, after 1995, were rising very rapidly. If you had had money in the stock market, you would have been very happy right then. And if people may remember, I'm sure you do remember, that at the end of 1996, while the stock market's running away, Alan Greenspan made that famous warning about irrational exuberance. The stock market has been overtaken by irrational exuberance. And of course, there was irrational exuberance because we just saw, and I wish I had brought the graph, I know you miss it desperately, but if I had had this graph, what it would have shown was stock market going like this and profitability going like this, actually going flat to 97 and that down. Alan Greenspan noticed this and called out about irrational exuberance, but in fact, even though the chairman of the Federal Reserve said, hey, things shouldn't go up, the stock market continued to rise, and Alan Greenspan did absolutely nothing about it. He failed to raise interest rates in the normal way. Not only that, but he lowered them at every point that the stock market seemed to be at all jittery. For example, in the late summer of 1997, when the Asian crisis began, or in late 1998, when the financial markets were freezing up. People may remember he lowered interest rates on three special occasions and in response to the financial problems. So as a result, whenever the market is threatened, people know that the Federal Reserve is going to bail out the stock market. And so what happens? Stock market just goes up and up and up. But Alan Greenspan knew what he was doing, at least within the constraints that he faced. I've often thought in doing this stuff, trying to think, oh, you know, here are all these stupid things that these people are doing. And then you try to think of doing something better. What would have been better for the economy at that point? And it's not so easy to think about, especially given at that point they had eschewed the possibility of normal Keynesian deficits. So Alan Greenspan has something else in mind. As a company's stock market valuation rises, the companies become worth more. They're able, therefore, to borrow money more easily. At the same time, especially high-tech companies, where the biggest stock market increases are taking place, they're able to issue shares, hugely overvalued shares, and raise massive funds. So this gave companies of all sorts an enormous increase in their liquidity, in their capacity to invest, which was, of course, extremely paradoxical, since this is a time that profit rates were going down. But the fact was that even though they were suffering from declining profitability, they were flush with cash, because they had the access to the credit markets and to selling shares that could counteract the problem of funds that might have appeared had they just relied on their own retained earnings. So they were flush with cash during this period, and this made a huge boom between 1995 and 2000. Investment grew fast, employment grew fast. We had the famous new economy boom. You guys remember that, new economy. What was going on? Greenspan realized that the economy on its own was short of demand. So what he did was exploit the wealth effect of rising asset prices to usher in a new form of stimulus, which I would call stock market Keynesianism, or asset price Keynesianism. Under traditional Keynesianism, the government borrows and spends to stimulate demand. Under stock market Keynesianism, thanks to the Federal Reserve's low interest rates, firms and individuals get increased wealth on the stock market. So you might think, who benefits by this particular form of economic stimulus? In any case, this allows them to borrow and spend, and in that way stimulate demand. In other words, private borrowing based on corporations and rich people getting even richer substitutes for public borrowing in driving the economy. So firms are able to borrow and spend and stimulate demand. And corporations invested a lot, households consumed a lot, and due to all that borrowing, and only due to that, we got the new economy boom. So that's the new economy boom. A new economy, what's new about the economy is not the technology, but this new macroeconomic method of management, stock market Keynesianism. But the problem was that the new economy boom was out without real foundations, because as I've been emphasizing, manufacturing profitability was going down. The growth of borrowing drove up stock prices in defiance of profits, and ratios between prices of company stocks and their earnings reached an all-time high, meaning prices are way out of line with profits. The growth of borrowing also drove up output, but because output grew in the face of already existing overcapacity, profitability in manufacturing fell even further, and it was only a matter of time before there would be a serious recession. In the year 2000, the new economy boom came to an abrupt end. Overcapacity all across the manufacturing sector made for a huge fall in profitability. The stock market crashed. The economy went into recession. So we're moving into what we're facing today. Now, the conditions I'm going to talk about are the conditions that create the present. The recession that took place in 2001 was naturally focused entirely on the manufacturing sector because that's where overcapacity was concentrated. The whole of the fall of profit rate in that period took place in manufacturing. The loss of jobs in manufacturing, 3 million jobs, 3 million jobs lost, a fifth of the manufacturing sector in about 4 years, accounted for all the jobs lost between 2000 and 2004. No increase in manufacturing capital stock for 4 years, and this accounts for all the decline in the growth of capital stock for the whole economy in this time. Simply put, the new economy, the so-called new economy, had really been about radically worsening manufacturing overcapacity, and the resulting recession delivered a huge shock to the system. 2000-2001, investment in GDP declined more rapidly than at any other point during the post-war period, and it looked like there might be a recession. And if you look, go back and look at the financial pages in that period, it's very bleak. But at that point, we still have Alan Greenspan around, he seems to be around forever, he came to the rescue again, and this with the same idea, asset price Keynesianism. At this point, housing prices, right, had already been going up pretty rapidly as rich people took their money that they were making in the stock market, that they had made in the stock market, and put into housing. In turn, Greenspan brought down interest rates extremely rapidly, and he kept them in real terms below zero for 3 years. In other words, real interest rates were negative. So people could now borrow cheaply, and demand for houses rose rapidly. As a result, housing prices skyrocketed between 2000 and 2005, just as stock prices had risen between 1995 and 2000. Because people's houses were now worth much more than before, they could borrow much more against their houses' value. And between 2000 and 2005, household borrowing as a percentage of household income smashes all records. You may think that people have been borrowing a lot lately. They have been borrowing a lot. They've been borrowing in order of magnitude more than any other time in American history out of personal income or GDP. It was the growth of personal consumption based on this borrowing that drove the economy and accounted for just about 100% of the boom that we've experienced, or the cyclical upturn, since 2000. Housing accounted for 30% of all growth that took place in that 2000 to 2005 period. So, as between 95 and 2000, between 2000 and the present, it's been asset prices that have come to the rescue of the economy. Instead of rising share prices, it's been rising housing prices that have driven the economy. But the question is, and that's the question we're facing right now, what's going to be the outcome? It was Greenspan's idea to rely on the wealth effect of housing prices to allow households and people to vastly increase their borrowing, that way vastly increase their consumption. Consumption would drive the economy, while corporations did very little. They would work off their overcapacity. They wouldn't be employing much. They wouldn't be investing much. They'd be cutting their plant and equipment and employment, undercutting, indeed, demand. But consumption would drive the economy based on housing. Greenspan expected then that some manufacturers would go bankrupt, others would ease up on investment and employment. Sooner or later, manufacturing profitability would rise, corporations would begin to increase investment and employment, once again driving the economy forward. In the meantime, households with their borrowing and consumption would keep the economy turning over. But the problem is that today, 6 years later, after Greenspan started to stimulate the economy with his low interest rates, the economy has barely responded. In this period, employment has grown by, without any remote comparison, the slowest in the whole post-war period since 1945. Investment has been growing about half the average of any cyclical recovery. Real wages have been flat, as people know. In other words, up till now, corporations have not yet begun to shoulder their responsibility for pushing the economy. As a result, the growth of GDP has been, again, the slowest for any comparable period since World War II, again, with the exception of that period around the 74-5 recession. What explains this pattern, and what can we expect? It seems to me likely, although you never really know, that Greenspan's policy is turning out to be counterproductive and actually backfiring. And I hope people will see that the motif that I'm about to kind of refer to is a repetitive one that what we've seen before. What we seem to be experiencing since the recession of 2000 and 2001 is a pattern that's been repeated throughout the long downturn. And that is a turn to one or another form of Keynesianism to drive the economy through increased borrowing. This time it's housing price Keynesianism. This borrowing does keep the economy turning over, but at the same time it prevents the shakeout that's needed to get rid of overcapacity and fully restore profitability and thereby the economy's dynamism. Remember, overcapacity was made much worse by the new economy boom. In any case, what happened, and this is normal, in response to the overcapacity, their reduced profit rates, starting in 2000, manufacturers cut back on investment, employment, and wages, as I said. This made especially for very low working class or, you know, popular incomes through employment, and therefore a huge hit to aggregate demand that the economy experienced over 4 or 5 years. So if Greenspan and the Fed had not intervened, there would very likely have been a serious recession. But there would also have been, perhaps, that major shakeout of high-cost, low-profit firms that has been needed. The Fed's intervention, in other words, did drive up housing prices, did that way drive up consumption, did in that way drive up economic growth, just as he hoped. But nevertheless, at the same time, precisely because he was driving up demand and creating this housing bubble, this demand undercuts the thing that's supposed to have been happening at the same time, which is that firms are going out of business, excess plant and equipment are being used up. And meanwhile, we're beginning to get, hopefully, employment and investment. But the problem has been that overcapacity has continued and continued to discourage investment and employment. So on the one hand, that's the one side of the problem. But the irony is the other side is that Greenspan's low interest rates, precisely instead of encouraging investment in plant and equipment, has failed to do that due to making possible the continuation of overcapacity. But it encourages paper investment. Low interest rates have encouraged people, rich people and corporations, to take their money and invest in all kinds of paper assets, bonds, commodities, and of course, especially housing. Simultaneously, instead of investing new plant and equipment or employing more workers at a time where demand isn't growing very much, firms have been paying off their debts and paying out in response to their stockholders huge dividends. They're full of money. They can give out to their rich people, and there's no shortage of high-end expenditure. At the same time, that money is being used to buy up more stocks, and firms themselves have been. People read, it makes the front page of the LA Times every once in a while. It's a huge boom of mergers and acquisitions. Companies are using that money, the profits, to buy up stocks rather than to invest. So over the past few years, corporations have spent historically unprecedented amount of their internal funds on buying equities and paying dividends, not investing. So just like the stock market bubble of the 90s eventually burst, the housing bubble is now beginning to deflate. As it does, people are borrowing much less than before. As they borrow much less, they're consuming less, and the economy, as people know, has been slowing over the past year. Against this background, it's possible that because firms have been getting more profits, that a sudden burst of investment and employment could save the day. But given that the slowdown is being driven by the deflation of the housing bubble, it's not easy to see what would motivate the corporation to invest in the face of stagnant demand. It's never easy or smart to predict what the economy is going to do, but since my own money is not involved, it looks much more likely to me that we'll see a new recession before we see any break in stagnation or a new long upturn. Thank you.
You have been listening to The Economics of Global Turbulence, the Advanced Capitalist Economies from Long Boom to Long Downturn, 1945 to 2005, given by the author, Dr. Robert Brenner, Professor of History, UCLA. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org.
We'll conclude the program with another installment of John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education, in which he's been explaining how the modern schooling system was transformed in the late 19th century to the mission of providing industrial capitalists with manageable workers for factories and offices. Workers who are now, by the way, less and less necessary due to the outsourcing of production to lower-wage countries. Might this explain the declining school system as it becomes a pipeline instead to prison, where American workers can finally be, as they say, competitive, earning less than the minimum wage as they work literally at gunpoint? Don't look to capitalism to provide everyone with a dignified and adequate livelihood. Profit-making won't allow it. Eliminate the system of profit, distribute the resources to all, and we can save the planet and live with dignity. Kirkpatrick Sale wrote in Economics of Scale versus the Scale of Economics, quote, "Economics of scale is what conventional industrial economies are all about, finding ways to more profitably and efficiently exploit nature. But the scale of economics is what the economies of the future must be about, finding ways to live so that healthy communities may foster a healthy earth. These are the only two essentials to consider in coming at the problem of the optimum scale for an economy to produce and distribute goods and services, the natural ecosystem and the human community. An economy that does harm to the natural world, depleting resources, extincting species, producing pollution, piling up wastes, has grown too large. An economy out of democratic and humanitarian control, where decisions are made by distant corporations and a polity whose choices are beyond individual influence, has grown too large. An economic scale optimum for the Earth's systems would be based on conservation, stability, sustainability, recycling, harmony," close quote. So now to John Taylor Gatto, continuing in Chapter 9 of The Underground History of American Education. The real explanation for the sudden gulf between NEA policies in 1893 and 1911 had nothing to do with intervening feedback from teachers, principals, or superintendents about what schools needed. Rather, it signaled titanic forces gathering outside the closed universe of schooling, with the intention of altering this nation's economy, politics, social relationships, future direction, and eventually the terms of its national existence, using schools as instruments in the work. Schoolmen were never invited to the policy table at which momentous decisions were made. When Elwood P. Cubberley began tentatively to raise his voice in protest against radical changes being forced upon schools, particularly the sudden enforcement of compulsory attendance laws, which brought amazing disruption into the heretofore well-mannered school world, he quickly pulled back without naming the community leaders, as he called them, who gave the actual orders. This evidence of impotence documents the pedagogue status of even the most elevated titans of schooling like Cubberley. You can find this reference and others like it in Public Education in the United States. Scientific management was about to merge with systematic schooling in the United States. It preferred to steal in silently on little cats' feet. But nobody ever questioned the right of businessmen to impose a business philosophy to tamper with children's lives. On the cantilever principle of interlocking directorates pioneered by Morgan interests, scientific school management flowed into other institutional domains of American life, too, according to Taylor, and that is the inventor of scientific management and time management. Application of mechanical power to production could be generalized into every arena of national life, even to the pulpit, certainly to schools. This would bring about a realization that people's lives could be regulated very much like machinery, without sentiment. Any expenditure of time and energy demanded rationalization. Whether first grader or coal miner, behavior should be mathematically accounted for following the new statistical procedures of Galton and Carl Pearson. The scientific management movement was backed by many international bankers and industrialists. In 1905, the vice president of the National City Bank of New York, Frank Vanderlip, made his way to the speaker's podium at the National Education Association's annual convention to say, quote, "I am firmly convinced that the economic success of Germany can be encompassed in a single word, schoolmaster. From the economic point of view, the school system of Germany stands unparalleled," close quote. German schools were psychologically managed. Ours must be too. People of substance stood, they thought, on the verge of an ultimate secret, how to write upon the empty slates of empty children's minds in the dawning era of scientific management. What they would write there was a program to make dwarf and fractional human beings, people crippled by implanted urges and habits beyond their understanding, men and women who cry out to be managed. Frederick Taylor's gospel of efficiency demanded complete and intensive use of industrial plant facilities. From 1903 onwards, strenuous efforts were made to achieve full utilization of space by forcing year-round school on society. Callahan suggests it was the children of America who would have been unwilling victims of this scheme who played a decisive role in beating the original effort to effect this back. But east of Chicago, in the synthetic U.S. Steel Company town of Gary, Indiana, Superintendent William A. Wirt, a former student of John Dewey's at the University of Chicago, was busy testing a radical school innovation called the Gary Plan, soon to be sprung on the national scene. Wirt had supposedly invented a new organizational scheme in which school subjects were departmentalized. This required movement of students from room to room on a regular basis, so that all building spaces were in constant use. Bells would ring, and just as with Pavlov's salivating dog, children would shift out of their seats and lurch toward yet another class. In this way, children could be exposed to many non-academic socialization experiences and much scientifically engineered physical activity, and it would be a bonus value from the same investment, a curriculum apart from so-called basic subjects, which by this time were being looked upon as an actual menace to long-range social goals. Work called his system the Work, Study, Play, School. But outside of Gary, it was referred to simply as the Gary Plan. Its noteworthy economical feature, rigorously scheduling a student body twice as large as before into the same space and time, earned it the informal name Platoon School. While the prototype was being established and tested on children of the new industrial proletariat in Gary, the plan itself was merchandised from newsstand, pulpit, and lecture circuit, lauded in administrative circles, and soundly praised by first pedagogical couple John and Evelyn Dewey in their 1915 book, Schools of Tomorrow. The first inkling Gary might be a deliberate stepchild of the scientific management movement occurred in a February 1911 article by Wirt for the American School Board Journal, Scientific Management of School Plants. But a more thorough and forceful exposition of its provenance was presented in The Elementary School Teacher by John Franklin Bobbitt in a 1912 piece titled Elimination of Waste in Education. Bobbitt said Gary schools were the work of businessmen who understood scientific management. Teaching was slated to become a specialized scientific calling conducted by pre-approved agents of the central business office. Classroom teachers would teach the same thing over and over to groups of traveling children. Special subject teachers would deliver their special subjects to classes rotating through the building on a precision time schedule. Early in 1914, the Federal Bureau of Education, then located in the Interior Department, strongly endorsed Wirt's system. This led to one of the most dramatic and least known events in 20th century school history. In New York City, a spontaneous rebellion occurred on the part of students and parents against the extension of the Gary Plan to their own city. While the revolt had only short-lived effects, it highlights the demoralization of private life occasioned by passing the methods of industry off as education. Less than 3 weeks before the mayoral election of 1917, rioting broke out at PS 171, an elementary school on Madison Avenue near 103rd Street in New York City, which had adopted the Gary Plan. About 1,000 demonstrators smashed windows, menaced passersby, shouted threats, and made school operation impossible. Over the next few days, newspapers downplayed the riot, marginalizing the rioters as, quote, street corner agitators from Harlem and the Upper East Side. But they were nothing of the sort, being mainly immigrant parents. Demonstrations and rioting spread to other Gary Plan schools, including high schools where student volunteers were available to join parents on the picket line. At one place, 5,000 children marched. For 10 days, trouble continued, breaking out in first one place, then another. Thousands of mothers milled around schools in Yorkville, a German immigrant section, and in East Harlem, complaining angrily that their children had been put on half rations of education. They meant that mental exercise had been removed from the center of things. Riots flared out in Williamsburg and Brownsville in the borough of Brooklyn. Schools were stoned, police car tires slashed by demonstrators. Schools on the Lower East Side and in the Bronx reported trouble also. The most notable aspect of this rioting was its source in what today would be the bottom of the bell curve masses, and they were complaining that school was too easy. What could have possessed recently arrived immigrants to defy their betters? Whatever it was, it poisoned the promising political career of mayoral incumbent John Perroy Mitchell, a well-connected, aristocratic young progressive who had been seriously mentioned as presidential timber. Although Teddy Roosevelt personally campaigned for him, Mitchell lost by a 2-to-1 margin when election day arrived shortly after the riots were over, the disruptions widely credited with bringing Mitchell down. In all, 300 students were arrested, almost all Jewish. I identify their ethnicity because today we don't usually expect Jewish kids to get arrested in bulk. To understand what was happening requires us to meet an entity calling itself the Public Education Association. If we pierce its associational veil, we find that it is made up of bankers, society ladies, corporation lawyers, and in general, people with private fortunes or access to private fortunes. The PEA announced in 1911 a, quote, urgent need to transform public schools into child welfare agencies. Shortly afterward, Mitchell, a member of the PEA, was elected mayor of New York. Superintendent Wirt Ingarry was promptly contacted and offered the New York superintendency. He agreed, and the first Gary schools opened in New York City in March 1915. Bear in mind, there was no public debate, no warning of this radical step. Just 75 days after the Gary trial began, the financial arm of New York City government declared it a total success, authorizing conversion of 12 more schools. The original trial had been only for two. This was done in June at the end of the school year, when public attention was notoriously low. Then, in September of 1915, after a net 100 days of trial, Comptroller Prendergast issued a formal report recommending extension of the Gary Plan into all schools of New York City. He further recommended lengthening the school day and the school year. At the very time this astonishing surprise was being prepared for the children of New York City in 1915, a series of highly laudatory articles sprouted like zits all over the periodical press, calling the Gary Plan the answer to our nation's school prayers. One characteristic piece read, quote, "School must fill the vacuum of the home. School must be life itself, as once the old household was a life itself." Close quote. Like Rommel's panzer columns, true believers were on the move. At the same time press agents were skillfully manipulating the press, officers of the Rockefeller Foundation, a body which supported the Gary Plan wholeheartedly, were appointed without fanfare as members of the New York City Board of Education, compliments of Mayor Mitchell. Immediately after Prendergast's report appeared calling for total Garyization of public schooling, a book written by a prominent young protege of John Dewey directed national attention to the Gary miracle, quote, where children learn to play and prepare for vocations as well as to study abstractions, close quote. Titled The Gary Schools, its author, Randolph Byrne, was among the most beloved columnists for the New Republic in the days when that magazine, product of J.P. Morgan banker Willard Strait's personal patronage, took some of its editorial instruction directly from the tables of power in America. In light of what happened in 1917, you might find it interesting to have your librarian scare up a copy of Byrne's Gary Schools, so you can study how a well-orchestrated national propaganda campaign can colonize your mind. Even as Byrne's book was being read, determined opposition was forming. In 1917, in spite of grassroots protest, the Elite Public Education Association urged the opening of 48 more Gary schools. There were by that time 32 in operation. Whoever was running the timetable on this thing had apparently tired of gradualism and was preparing to step from the shadows and open the engine full throttle. A letter from the PEA director to the New York Times on June 27th of 1917, urged that more Gary schools must be opened. An earlier letter by Director Nudd struck an even more hysterical note, quote, "The situation is acute, no further delay." This Hegelian manufactured crisis was used to thaw Board of Estimate recalcitrants, which body voted sufficient funds to extend the Gary scheme through the New York City school system. School riots followed hard on the heels of that vote. European immigrants, especially Jews from Germany, where collectivist thinking in the West had been perfected, knew exactly what the scientific Gary Plan would mean to their children. They weren't buying. In the fallout from these disturbances, socialite Mitchell was thrown out of office in the next election. Gary schools themselves were dissolved by incoming Mayor Hyland, who called them a scheme of the Rockefeller Foundation, a system by which Rockefellers and their allies hope to educate coming generations in the, quote, doctrine of contentment, another name for social serfdom. And I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education, the result of more than a decade of research that seeks to explain the intellectual decline of America. Gatto was an award-winning teacher who resigned from the profession after concluding, 30 years into his career, that he was participating in a system that was damaging the minds of children. You can learn more about his work at johntaylorgatto.com. Cops of the World was by Phil Oakes, and our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Welcome Guest.